turkey. Everybody eats turkey. Question is whether the turkey is a kosher, is a kosher bird. In Maseches Chulin, the laws of kashrus are discussed from the beginning of the Masechta to the end. And towards the end of the perek, Elu Trefos, the kashrus of the birds, is discussed in the Mishnah. In the Chumash, the Torah doesn't give us simonim to identify which bird is kosher and which bird is non-kosher. The Torah gives you the list of the non-kosher birds. Anything that's not on the list is kosher. But the Mishnah tells you the simonim, how to identify whether any given bird is kosher or not. It's a famous sugi, is known as the sugi of Nesher. Nesher is usually assumed to be an eagle. The Rabbi and Tom claims the word Nesher does not mean an eagle, it means a different bird, it doesn't make too much of a difference. Nesher is not a kosher bird. There's a famous, complicated comment by the Rabbeinu Zrachi Halevi, the author of the Sefer HaMo'or, on that sugya. He has his own shita. So you look in the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch tells you, what are the simonim? How can you identify whether a bird is kosher or non-kosher? So what happened was that when Christopher Columbus came back to Europe with the turkeys, he came back to our Sfardish community. So by the Sfardim, they followed the din in the Gemara. That if the bird has the simonim to identify that it's a kosher bird, you're allowed to eat it. After 50 years or so of the Sfardim eating the bird, so the Ashkenazim and the other countries looked over the border, and they saw that the Sfardim are eating the turkey, so they assumed they must have had a tradition that the turkey is kosher, so they started eating the turkey. And then, 200 years later, the Ashkenazim woke up, what's going on? The Gemara there, in that Sugya of Nesher, tells a story, the Gemara relates a story, that the Amoraim misidentified a bird. They came upon a new bird that they never heard of before, and they misidentified the bird as a kosher bird because they made a mistake of one of the simonim. They thought that it had this extra toe, and it didn't have an extra toe. It has to have an etzbi yisera. And they made a mistake, so they discontinued eating the bird. They stopped. So Rashi comments on that Gemara, if the holy Amoraim made a mistake identifying the bird, we should be careful, and we shouldn't rely on our own identification. We should only eat a bird if we have a tradition from earlier generations that is established by great Torah scholars that the bird is kosher. You should never eat any new birds unless you have a kabbalah, unless you have a tradition. So that's what Rashi writes. The Ramoa in Shulchan Aruch, as you know, Rabbi Yosef Kara wrote to Shulchan Aruch, and he usually follows the psak of the Svardim. Rabbi Yosef Kara was a Svardim. He lived in Eretz Yisrael in the 1500s. At that time, there were only Svardim in Eretz Yisrael. There were no Ashkenazim. The Ramoa lived in Poland and Krakow. Same time, he was a contemporary of Rabbi Yosef Kara, and he touches up the Shulchan Aruch even there that it should apply to the Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim have every so often a disagreement with the Svardim. So the Ramoa in Shulchan Aruch quotes this minhag of Rashi. He doesn't quote it from Rashi, he quotes it from the Sefer Issa v'Heter. There is a Sefer called Issa v'Heter Ha'oruch by Rabbeinu Yoina Ashkenazi. There were two famous Rabbeinus. There was Rabbeinu Yoina Girondi, who wrote the Shari Tshuva, and who wrote his students, Talmid Rabbeinu Yoina, wrote the commentary on the side of the Rif Brochas. Then you have the Rabbeinu Yoina Ashkenazi, who wrote the Issa v'Heter. He's quoted on every page and every day. The Ramah quotes him all the time and every page because he only quotes Rashi and Tosfos. He never quotes anything from the Svardim. So the Ramah quotes this minig of Rashi from the Issa v'Heter Ha'oruch that you shouldn't eat any bird unless you have a tradition from earlier generations that it's kosher. In other words, you should not rely on your own identification of the simonim of the bird because you may be making a mistake. So around 200 years after the Ashkenazim started eating, 100 years, at least 100 years after the Ashkenazim started eating the turkey, some of the Rabbanim woke up and they realized, what's going on? We're in violation of Aminik. So some of them stopped eating turkey, most of them continued eating turkey. Eretz Yisrael has one of the highest, it may be the highest percentage of eating turkey in the world. I think it could be. One of the very highest percentages of turkey consumers in the world. Bottom line, almost everybody eats turkey, even though it's really a violation of the minhag of Rashi. In the side of the commentary on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, they quote the Shalom, the author of the Shnei Luchos Habris, whose name is Rabbi Yeshaya Horowitz, a lady, that he didn't eat turkey and his descendants don't eat turkey. There's a Rebbe here in Yeshiva across the street, Rabbi David Horowitz, Halevi, who is a descendant of the Shalom. So he says, all the descendants of the Shalot don't eat turkey. He says he has cousins who eat Chazer on Yom Kippur. The turkey they won't eat. You know, the family tradition, you don't eat turkey, so you don't eat turkey. They don't understand why not. So that's the story. To identify whether a bird is kosher or not, you have there are simonim. And the Shulchan Aruch says you can rely on the simonim. And the Ramah, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, says the Ashkenazim don't rely on the simonim. We have to have a tradition. As far as fish are concerned, to identify whether any given fish is kosher or treif, so the Torah gives simon. The Torah says it depends on snapir, likas keses, has to have fins and scales. It's impossible to require that you should have a tradition on fish. There are tens of thousands of fish all over the world. You ain't gonna have no tradition on any fish. Fish are every sea, every body of water in the world has different fish. So the Rosh had a few sons who were all very learned. So one of the sons of the Rosh, Ben Yehuda, Ben Arosh, has a collection of tshuvas where he writes, and he's quoted by the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, that there's no need for any masora regarding fish. All you have to see is that it has snapped with the kaskeses. Do the kaskeses, do the scales have to have any specific shape or any specific form? So some Shulchan Aruch, any shape, any form, anything is acceptable. There is an ongoing debate in South Africa. Many years ago, 7 years ago, there was a very prominent rabbi there by the name of Rabbi Kosofsky, who was a brother-in-law of Rabbi Chaim Ozer, who lived in Vilna. They used to correspond to each other. Rabbi Shulman, who's a rabbi across the street, who was a rabbi in a synagogue in Flatbush, is a descendant, a grandson of this Rabbi Kosofsky. So this Rabbi Kosofsky paskened the law of Shaila 7 years ago. One of them is that there's a specific fish that only is found over there in the ocean below South Africa, known as the kingklip. So he paskened that fish is kosher. So ever since, every 10 years somebody makes a tumult. Somebody recently, about 8 years ago, someone put out a whole book just to ask the kingklip. This person who put out the book met me. I happened to be in Johannesburg. So the last day I was there, he especially came to the shul where I was davening, and he gave me a copy of the book. And the balabosa was going to drive me to the airport to go back home. Said to me, "You know that man?" So I said, "Yeah." He said, "Nobody in the community talks to him, because he published the whole book attacking the bezin, because the local bezin said the kingklip is kosher. He followed the psak of Rabbi Kosofsky from 70 years ago. And the people don't give him an aliyah, they don't let him daven for an omen, they're not mitzarf and tominya, they treat him as if he's in chair. The issue with the kingklip is, you don't need a masora, it has fins and scales, but the scales are so soft, it's like consistency of flesh. It's not plastic-like. Whenever you scrape off scales from a fish, it's like plastic, so some of them are rectangular shape, some of them are circular shape. But over here, it has the consistency of flesh. It's like skin. So that's a question. In the days of the Bali Atosis, there was a big dispute regarding Barbuta. Barbuta is a French name of some kind of a fish. And Tosis says, back and forth, whether Barbuta is kosher or not. What's the issue with the Barbuta? So there's a machlokes on top of a machlokes. One dispute in the poskim is, what if you have a sea animal that has fins and scales, and it has legs and hands also? It's not a fish. It's an animal of the sea. It happens to have fins and scales. But it's not really a fish. So that's one dispute. So many poskim say it's still mutter. I think the majority of the poskim say it's still mutter. These Bali Atosis are assuming not so. That it's if it's a sea animal, but it's not, it doesn't look like a fish, doesn't have the shape of a fish, that's not it's not mutter just based on fins and scales. So now they had a further machlokes. What constitutes the shape of a fish? So we know a fish has a mouth, it has eyes, then it goes like this, and it has a tail. So in most of the kosher fish, the tail indents and goes out again. So the Barbuta was a fish that the tail was straight, in the corner of the tail was straight. Instead of indenting, going out again, the tail was straight. So that was a dispute. Rabbi Neperitz, who has the comments on the side of the Sefer Mitzvah's cotton, the smock, explains that was the Nekuda Samachulikas, that was the point of dispute. There were Rishonim who got carried away. They said, you're not allowed to eat that fish, it's not kosher, because that doesn't have the shape of a fish. That's a sea animal, but it's not a fish. In order to be considered a fish, it has to have a tail that's indented. We clearly don't follow that because everybody eats, all Orthodox Jews eat sole, is the name of a fish, and the sole has a straight tail. It is not indented. So we have not accepted that opinion. As far as identifying which animals are kosher, so the Torah says you have to have malagera and mafris parso. No one ever brought up the possibility that you have to have a tradition. As long as it has split hoofs, it has to be split through and through, and it has to chew its cud. The Gemara speaks about this shesua, the chumash lists off some animals which are malagera, not mafris parso, some are mafris parso, not malagera, that they're not kosher. In order to be kosher, it has to have both siman, it has to be both malagera and mafis parsa. Then the Torah says shesua is not permissible. What in the world is a shesua? So Rashi in his commentary, Achumish quotes from the Gemara, shesua is an animal that is both malagera and mafis parsa, and nonetheless it's not kosher because it has shnei gabin u'shnei shedros. It has two separate backs and two spines. So what does that mean? So that's a dispute between Rabbi Shmuel and the Gemara. So one opinion in the Gemara that such an animal cannot exist. It would die. It'll exist a few days, then it's going to die. So what are we talking about? It's an eifel. You can't shecht an eifel. Of course it's not going to be kosher. So they say the only time the Torah speaks about a shesua that you're not allowed to eat it is if it's a shesua ben pekua. Ben pekua means if you shecht a cow that's pregnant, And after you shech the cow, then you take out the fetus, then you take out the uber. So that's called the ben pekua. Some people make a mistake. They think ben pekua is the name of a tana, like ben azai and ben zoyma, something like that. Ben pekua is not a holy tana. It's an animal that the fetus of a cow that's taken out after you shech the mother. So the ben pekua does not, min ha-Torah does not require its own shechita. It is nita v'shechitas imo. And the rabbanon, the din is that if it's Hifris agavi karka, if the ben pekua was born and is jumping around, walking around, so then mishum marazayin, you have to shecht it. Since the shechita is only mishum marazayin, so there's a whole discussion in the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch whether we cite a brocha or not, because it's not a real din that it really needs shechita midrabbanan, only mishum marazayin, so maybe you're not supposed to say a brocha, maybe yes. So it's a whole discussion there. So again, one opinion in the Gemara is that a shesua, the Gemara says a shesua is an animal that has malagera and mafis parasa, but because it's a hashnei gab and a shnei shedros, shesua means split, its back is split in two separate spines, so therefore you're not allowed to eat. So one opinion in the Gemara, no such animal can exist. It's physically, biologically impossible, and the Torah is speaking about a shesua ben pekua. Even though I shech the mother, and whatever is found inside, whatever kind of an uber is found inside the mother is mutter, but if I find the shesua inside, you're not allowed to eat. The other opinion is not true. If I have a ben pekua, I am allowed to eat it, even if it's a shesua. Such an animal can exist, and the Torah is prohibiting such an animal that's a malager, mafis parson, has shnei gabin and shnei shedros. So in the Shulchan Aruch, they say we paskin lechumer. They're not sure whether such an animal can exist or not. So they say, Safik deraisa l'chumra. They assume that such an animal cannot live, and therefore the Torah must be speaking about a ben pekua shesua. It says, you're not allowed to eat a ben pekua shesua. I remember when we were studying in this building, we were studying Yeridei with Rabbi Soloveitchik, so he said to the students, and don't laugh and don't think that it's never going to happen, a ben pekua shesua. He used to supervise the slaughterhouse in Boston, and he was only there a few hours a week. He wasn't there every single day. And he saw quite a few times a ben pekua shesua. He used to have Dean Adler. He used to be the dean of the college. Now he's a professor in the college. So he once spoke about this. So he said, yeah, that's an abnormal formation. And every so often you have a fetus that's a shesua. And he told me that he published a book, and the picture of shesua is on the cover of the book. Okay. He never knew that the rabbis had a whole discussion in the Talmud, whole discussion in the Shulchan Aruch, but he said, that's the photograph, that's the picture on the cover of his book. The Torah Tmima, in his commentary on the Chumash, when he quotes this comment from the Gemara about the Shesua, quotes a kasha that commentary says, that in the books on biology, they write that in the African jungles, there is such an animal that's a Shesua, and it does live, it does survive. has two separate spines, two separate backs, has malager, mafis parsa, and it does survive. So he raises the question, maybe we should reverse the psak and the Shulchan Aruch. The whole machlekes in the Gemara was, can such an animal survive? So that's what the Torah is talking about. A shesua, malager, mafis parsa, shnei gav, shnei shedros. What if it would be a bempeku, a shesua would be mutter? It should be assumed such an animal cannot possibly exist. It would die a day or two after it's born. So the Torah must be talking about bempeku, a shesua. So now that we see in the African jungle such an animal does exist, so we should reverse the psak and the Shulchan Aruch. It says bempeku, a shesua is also. Maybe we should reverse the psak. So he quotes this question. He raises this question in his commentary on Chumash VaYikra. Maybe we should reverse the psak. So it's interesting that about 10 years ago, the, botanist, this is botany or what, zoologists, every so often have an international convention, they had a convention, and they came to the realization that they misidentified the animal. That animal in the African jungles is not malagera. Not everyone who's chewing gum is a malagera. Malagera means that the food is digested in the stomach, that it goes back out to the mouth. The animal chews it again, goes back down, and it goes back up after it's digested. This animal in the African jungles is not malagera. So the world zoologists were fooled. So the whole kashuba is based on a mistake. So far, they have not found that animal. That's malagera, mafis, parsa, with two spines that can survive. But it's interesting. The world of zoology made a mistake for so many years. Do you need a Kabbalah Dili tradition in order to identify an animal as a malager, mafis, parsa? We should really raise the question, now that we just found out 8 years ago that the world zoologists were mistaken for 100 years, that they thought that animal in the African jungle is malagera, they realized they made a mistake. So the rabbis can certainly make a mistake. We're not zoologists, and maybe you should say you're not allowed to eat any animal unless you have a tradition that it's a malagera. But the question is that so? So there is an issue that came up in the early years of Medinas Yisrael, soon after 1948. First chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael in recent, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi in Eretz Yisrael in recent years was Rabbi Cook, Zuchan Larocha, Rabbi Avram Yitzchak HaKayin Cook. After he passed away in 35 or so, so the next chief rabbi was Rabbi Herzog, Chief Rabbi Herzog Halevi. Third chief rabbi was a Yisrael, Rabbi Yuntelin, Kohen Levi Yisrael. So when Rabbi Herzog was the chief rabbi, there was a big issue regarding the zebu. The zebu is an animal that's malagera mafis parsa, and it originated, it's very common in Argentina, and it's very common in India, I think. And the Jews in India shechted for years. The Jews were eating the zebu animal, they shechted, has malagera mafis parsa, they shechted and they eat the meat. The zebu has a mila that it doesn't have to drink so much. It's a very dry area, India. And Eretz Yisrael is a dry climate. Argentina apparently also pretty dry. So it's like a camel in the sense that the camel can drink water and it has enough water in its system for 3 days. It doesn't have to keep on drinking water every day. And the zebu gives off milk, gives off delicious milk. So they wanted to introduce, in the dairy farms in Eretz Yisrael, they wanted to introduce the zebu because it gives off milk that tastes almost as good as cow's milk. Not exactly as good, almost as good as cow's milk. And it doesn't have to drink as much. So it would have been a wonderful thing. So they're going to introduce it. They're going to import these zebus from India. So the Chazon Ish corresponded with Rabbi Herzog at that time. And he said, this would be fine for everybody except for the Litvakis. Because the Jews in Lithuania follow the Chayei Adam like the Bible. And the Shach has a comment in Yerideya that runs as follows. We have to know whether any given animal is a behema or a chaya. As far as shkit, it's exactly the same. Yishecht it the same way. As far as malager, mafis, parsa, the same thing. But there are a few differences. One difference is when yishecht the behema, there is no mitzvah of kisui hadam. When yishecht a chay or an oaf, then the chumash has a mitzvah of kisui hadam. You have to have sawdust on the floor. Yishecht it, let's say when yishecht the turkeys, when yishecht chickens, so they have a floor full of sawdust. And they shecht 100 turkeys a minute, almost. They shecht very quickly. They shecht around 50 turkeys a minute. Every second they shecht another turkey, 1, 2, 3. And then after the shecht is shechting for an hour, then they get another shecht, the shecht takes over. So there's a mitzvah to say bracha al kisei adam and to throw a whole sack full of sawdust on top of the dam. So you have ofer melamata and ofer melamali. You have to have sawdust, the sand, the earth, something soft that if you plant something it would grow. That's the mitzvah of kisei adam. So the mitzvah of kisei adam does not apply to behemah. Chumash, it says, only applies to chaya or of. So it's important to know whether any given animal is a behemah or a chaya when you have the mitzvah of kisei adam. There are other differences also, a few more differences. Another major difference is regarding chelev. There are certain sections of the animal that are declared as chelev, and chelev is an isakaris, that you're not allowed to eat chelev. So chelev is only prohibited if it's a chelev behemah. A chelev of a chaya, the exact same parallel, exact same piece of chelev, fatty substance that has membranes around it. The chelev and the chaya is mut, and the chelev the behemah is also. So the Shach writes that in order to identify an animal as a chaya, that you should be permitted to eat the chelev, that there's no isakaris in eating the chelev, you have to have a tradition. You have to have a kabbalah, a tradition from earlier generations, that this is identified as a chaya. Because it's not so easy to identify an animal as a chaya, as opposed to a behemah, it depends on the shape of the horns. So you got to be a farmer and you have to know what shape the horns are supposed to look like to declare whether it's a chaya or a behemah. So the Shah says we don't get involved in this. A deer is a chaya, that we know. And a cow is a behemah. And anything other than a deer and a cow, you got to have a tradition to know whether it's a behemah or a chaya. So fine, so that's not so bad. The Chaye Odom, who wrote on Chaye Odom, is a book that has all the psalchim from Shulchan Aruch HaRechaim. And the Chochma Sodom has all the psalchim from the Yoridei. And by the Lithuanians, the Jews that come from Lithuania, the Chaye Odom and the Chochma Sodom were followed like the Bible. Chaye Odom was a mechutna of the Vilna Goy. That's what he claims. Not exactly, he was a mechutna of the son of the Vilna Goy, but it sounds like it sounds better to say, I'm a mechutna of the Vilna Goy. So he printed the hesped that he delivered when his mechut and the Vilna Gaon passed away. Whenever he quotes anything from the Vilna Gaon, he said, my mechut and the Vilna Gaon said, okay, I would also bring if I would be the mechut of the son of the Vilna Gaon. So the Chochma Sodom writes in his book that the Lithuanians follow like the Bible. He quotes in the name of the Shah that the custom in Lithuania is that you only eat an animal if it has malagera, mafris, parsa, and you have a tradition that it's kosher. That's not really what it says in the Shach. In the Shach it says to establish whether any given animal is a behemah or a chaya. That's complicated. That depends on the shape of the horns. Complicated passage in the Gemara. So the Shach says, we don't get involved in the shape of the horns. You have to have a tradition that it's from earlier Rabbanah, from earlier generation, that it's a chaya to allow the eating of the chela. So the Chochma Sodom does not quote it like that. The Chochma Sodom claims that the meaning of Lithuania is that you don't eat any animal just based on Malagera, Mafris, Parsa. You have to have a tradition. In light of what happened 8 years ago or 10 years ago, it makes sense. All the zoologists of the world realized that they fell in. They made a mistake 100 years ago in identifying this animal as a Malagera. It really isn't a Malagera. Okay. So this was the big issue. So Rabbi Herzog thought that they should permit the importing of the zebu for the dairy industry, and the Chazanish prevailed that they should not. Then Rabbi Herzog investigated a little bit, so he said, the religious Jews in India had a tradition. They always used to eat the zebu. They used to shecht it and eat the zebu. So the Chazanish responded. They have the whole correspondence is in print, very interesting. So the Chazanish responded, a tradition is not sufficient that religious Jews do it. You have to have learned Torah scholars in that country. And unfortunately, the Jews in India never had big Talmidei Chachamim there, so that's not considered a tradition. So Rabbi Herzog gave in. So for many years, they didn't permit the zebu in Eretz Yisrael. But then, non-Jews were breeding, cross-breeding the zebu with cows. And they came to the realization that if you have 5/8 of one and 3/8 of the other, I already forgot 5/8 of which one, 3/8 of the other one, then you have the best of both worlds. The milk tastes exactly like cow's milk. It doesn't taste like zebu milk. And it has the mila that it doesn't have to drink so much water. It's like the camel that only has to drink water every 3 days, and it can survive in the very warm climate of the Middle East. So once you're not allowed to crossbreed two different animals. That's an avera. That's harboaz beiva. Even non-Jews are not permitted to do that. It's not for neshevim mitzvahs bnei noach that they deserve the penalty of death for, but it's still the Talmud has a dispute, and the accepted opinion in the Shulchan Aruch is that non-Jews are not allowed to crossbreed animals. But they didn't ask us to show. They were crossbreeding the animals, and it worked out that it's 5/8 and 3/8. Once you know that they can give birth to a lot, they can mate together, give birth to a lot, then the fact that we have a tradition, we know that the cow is kosher, that carries over to the zebu also, because the Gemara tells us in Chorus, in the first parak, that a kosher and a non-kosher animal are so different that they cannot, you cannot breed them together. They cannot have a vlad that'll be able to live if they'll crossbreed them. So the fact that we have a tradition, everybody knows that cow's meat is kosher, cow is kosher, and they did succeed in crossbreeding. It was Bavera, but they did succeed in crossbreeding the cows with the zebus. So therefore, we assume that the zebu meat is kosher. This issue woke up again for 50 years. It was quiet. In the days of Rav Herzog, the Chazanish prevailed, so they did not import the zebu into Eretz Yisrael. And then they were crossbreeding them, and then they discovered 5/8 and 3/8, and then they did import them to Eretz Yisrael, and then they were shechting it, and they were importing meat from Argentina for many years. They were shechting in Argentina. And in Argentina, they don't check. They shecht zebu and they shecht the cow. And they were using the hide to make parchment, to make tefillin from these zebus. And tefillin can only be written. The Talmud says tefillin can, say the third tefillin of mezuzah have to be written on hide from a kosher animal. You can't take hide from a non-kosher animal. You can't take hide and make it into parchment, but it'll be puzzle. The Sefer Torah, the tefillin will be puzzle. So they were doing this for years. And then all of a sudden, about 7 years ago, they woke up on a Friday, and some rabbi from Bnei Brak notified all the people, no one should eat their cholent to Shabbos, everything is straight, you've got to throw out your pots, everything is straight. They woke up again with the zebu story, that the butcher shops in Bnei Brak and all over Eretz Yisrael were selling the meat from Argentina, and the meat from Argentina, some of it was zebu. So the Rabbanim explained at that time, the dispute in the days of Rav Herzog, that's because they didn't yet realize that the two can breed together, the cows with the zebu. But now they've already been breeding them together, bavera. You're not allowed to crossbreed two animals. But now that they see that they can breed them together, so the fact that we have a masar, we have a tradition on the cows at their kosher, so obviously the zebu is also kosher. If it wouldn't be kosher, the Gemara says they wouldn't be able to breed together. And then they pointed out, if you're going to say you have to throw out all of your pots and all of your meat, all of your cholent, and all of your tefillin and all of your sifitah are also possible, because in the last 50 years, everybody has been using all of these hides from Argentina to write tefillin and mezuzahs on. So that was that. After a week, the whole machlek is quieted down. Shalom al Yisrael. I remember that Shabbos that the whole dispute broke out in Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Avram Shapira's son was visiting in YU and he ate by me on Shabbos. So he was having a good laugh about this. Why they woke up all of a sudden after 50 years, tumul again about the zebu. This morning I just came back from Eretz Yisrael. So as I was waiting to get my luggage in JFK, so I met a classmate of mine from 50 years ago, who lives in Eretz Yisrael, came in for the wedding of my grandchild. He's obviously a little older than me. I don't have any married grandchildren. So he asked me, what's the whole tumult about the bugs, about the worms and the fish? So let's talk what to discuss. The Torah says that we're not permitted to eat sheretz ha'orf. Sheretz ha'orf means a non-kosher bird that doesn't have the kosher siman. And sheretz ha'mayim is a non-kosher fish, doesn't have snap of the kaskesis. Sheretz ha'oretz are worms, are bugs, so on. So worms are not permissible. So the Gemara says, if the worms are found in the fish, it depends where they're found. If they're found in the stomach of the fish, then they're not kosher. But if they're found in the flesh of the fish, then they are kosher. So the literal translation of the words of the Gemara were always assumed to mean that the worms that are found in the flesh of the fish are kosher because the flesh of the fish converted into a worm. It's fish. You're eating fish. And fish don't need any shechita, so the worm doesn't need any shechita. It's part of the fish. So there was a scholar by the name of Louis Pasteur, lived in the 1700s. He came up with the big chiddush that there ain't no such thing as spontaneous generation, and dirt doesn't develop into worms, and fish doesn't develop into worms either. You have to have eggs from a previous worm that hatched and developed into worms. There is no such thing that fish develops into worms. So that was in the 1700s he discovered this. So some of the rabbanim just woke up in the 1900s, 200 years later, and they said, whoa, that's Apicursus. To say that there's no such thing, that's against the Talmud. But the scientists tell us that all of the worms and the fish came from the outside, that the fish eats it, goes into the stomach, and then it goes from the stomach, penetrates through the membrane, and goes into the flesh. So all of the worms in the flesh are treif, because the Gemara says only such worms are kosher that grew in the fish, that developed in the fish. But the scientists say that all of the worms come from the outside. The scientists say there never was, there never will be such a thing as worms that develop. That's Apicursus, so that we don't accept. But what they said, that all the worms that we have, so you're not allowed to eat any of the worms. But the Jews were always eating herring, and herring is full of worms. So the holy worms, those worms you can't start up with. Those worms, our parents, our grandparents, in Europe we're always eating herring. So those worms are kosher. Any other fish other than herring, those worms you're not allowed to eat. So that's ridiculous to distinguish between the worms in the herring and the worms in the other fish. Either you want to prohibit all the worms or not. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wrote an essay about this many years ago. Moshe Feinstein refused to write an essay about it. They asked him whether the worms in the fish are kosher or not, because now we realize no such thing as spontaneous generation. So he says, so what? The rabbis ate the worms. They said the worms are kosher. However you interpret the passage in Gemara, the worms are kosher. So they asked him to write a tshuva. So he said, what is there to write a tshuva? People will laugh at me. You only write a tshuva when there's a shaila, and you have to work hard and figure out what the din is. It says in the Gemara in the Shulchan Aruch that the worms are mutter. He didn't want to write a tshuva. Shlomo Zalman wasn't afraid of being laughed at, so he wrote that even though we now know there's no such thing as spontaneous generation, we have to understand, we have to reinterpret what the passage in the Gemara means, that when the worms, when you have these eggs of the worms in the fish, they're microscopic, they're not visible to the naked eye, and it looks to the naked eye as if the flesh of the fish turned into worms. That's what it looks like. So that's what the Talmud says. If it looks like the flesh of the fish turned into worms, so then it's permissible. That's what he said. So that's a big ongoing debate now. Some people went to Rabbi Eliashib and they wound him up, and he said that you're not allowed to eat any of the fish that have any of the worms in it. They didn't ask him about the herring worms, the exact same worms. Basa b'cholov is also a prohibition. You're not allowed to eat meat cooked in milk. Sometimes you have a biblical prohibition, sometimes it's a rabbinical prohibition. Whenever it's a biblical prohibition, not only is it also b'achila, it's also asa b'hanor. So if by mistake you cook meat and milk accidentally, you can't give it to your next door neighbor who's not Jewish that they should eat. You can't give it to your maid to take home, because then she'll appreciate it and they'll probably give you something back in exchange. So that's considered getting hanor. So you have to really throw it out in the garbage. If you only cook basa b'cholov the rabbanon, it's only basa b'cholov the rabbanon, then it's muta b'hanor and it's muta b'bishul. There is a dispute in the days of the Tanoim whether cooking chicken with milk constitutes a biblical prohibition of the Rabbanon. So the accepted view is that the chicken and milk is only the Rabbanon, so therefore it's muta b'bishul and it's muta b'hanor, it's only also b'achila. When you have basa b'cholov the rice, you have all of the three prohibitions, also b'bishul. Let's say a person, it happens every so often, a person is in the army and his job is to cook the food in the kitchen, he's cooking for non-Jews and attempt to cook basa b'cholov. So if they attempt to cook chicken and milk, that's permissible. It's only basa b'cholov rabbanon, it's muta b'bishul, only also b'achila. But if they attempt to cook meat and milk, so he has to say, it's against my religion. I'm not allowed to cook meat and milk even though it's intended for non-Jews to eat. It's not intended for Jews to eat. So you have to know whether you're dealing with basa b'cholov deraisa or basa b'cholov derabbanon. A lot of dog food that's sold in the store, canned dog food, is basa b'cholov. The favorite is basa b'cholov. It's meat cooked in milk. And basa b'cholov is also b'hanor. is not chicken, it's animal meat. So if you feed it to your dogs, that's considered getting hanor. Or if you run such a business, a multi-billion-dollar business, selling it, so you're getting hanor. If you're the storekeeper and you're selling dog food, so you're getting hanor from it. So that's a question, whether it's really asur b'hanor. What's the issue? We have a principle in the Gemara, ein isur chal al isur. If something is treif already, if something is usur for one reason, and all of a sudden an additional reason pops up, now, later, why it should be usur for another reason. So there are cases where I say the second isur doesn't take effect. You only remain with the first isur. For example, one who eats on Yom Kippur is chayv koris. So what if you have a piece of non-kosher food, an erev Yom Kippur? But the non-kosher food is, let's say, non-kosher meat from the A&P. So you're not chayv koris on eating nevela. That's called nevela. People don't know. There's a difference between nevela and treif. In Yiddish, you call anything that's not kosher is treif. But strictly speaking, it's not accurate. If an animal never had a proper shechita, that's called nevela. If it had a proper shechita, but it has a sickness, it has some disease, so you have 70 treifas. There are 70 different, there are 7 categories of treifas, and there are 70 specific sicknesses in an animal that make it into a treifas. So if you had a perfect shechita, but the animal had a broken leg, or it had a perfect shechita, but the animal has an adhesion on the lung, that's usually the issue. There's a sircha on the lung, that's a higher percentage than all the other treifas. So then, the shechita was perfect, it's metame de nevela, the dead animal is not metame. If you pick up a piece of meat in the A&P, you become tame, because it's a nevela, it's not just a trefa. If you pick up a piece of trefa, had a proper shechita, but it's a diseased animal, so that's called trefa, that's not nevela, that's not metame. So the companies who prepare this dog food, they don't take animals that are geschochten. They don't take slaughtered animals that were had a proper shechita. They take nevela meat and they cook it with milk. So the Nari Behuda was a major posek in the 1700s. He was a contemporary of the Vilna Gaon. Contemporary, he lived in Prague. Vilna Gaon lived in Vilna, but they corresponded a little bit. So the Nari Behuda has a commentary on the printed on the side of the Shulchan Aruch. He thinks that if you took nevela meat and you cooked it with milk, we should apply the rule of Ein Iser Chal Al Iser, that the second prohibition of Basa B'cholav does not take effect, it only remains with an Iser of Nevela. Like on Yom Kippur, the Gemara talks about this. Let's say have non-kosher meat from the A&P. So non-kosher meat, there's no Iser Koris. You're not allowed to eat Nevela meat. Then when it comes Yom Kippur, there's an Iser Koris, if a healthy person eats. The person is sick and he has to eat, it's permitted to eat. But if one is not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur and he violates the din, then it's punished with kares. So one Tana is of the opinion that the prohibition of Yom Kippur doesn't take effect on non-kosher meat. So if you eat a piece of nevela on Yom Kippur, you won't be chayv kares. Because ein isa Yom Kippur chal al isa nevela. Well, let's say if a person is sick and a person has to eat on Yom Kippur, so we would recommend he should eat non-kosher food. Tell him to eat non-kosher meat. Because it'll only be alive. Don't tell him to eat kosher meat. Eat kosher meat. So his bikuach nefesh situation is being doicha the isa koris of eating Yom Kippur. If he eats non-kosher meat, bikuach nefesh condition is doicha lesser isa. So whenever mishum bikuach nefesh, you have to violate something. So the Talmud says you have to try to violate the lesser of the two evils. Try to figure out which is the lesser of the yisr. So the Nari Behuda, Rabbi Cheskel Landau, wrote that if the dog food is made from nevela, which it is, then the yisr basa b'cholav does not set in. So it's only an yisr of nevela. So nevela, it's muta b'hano. And the overwhelming majority of the poskim reject his opinion based on Gemaris. He's done a lot of Gemara, so there's a lot to discuss about that. It is a problem. Apashta says that there is a problem. The Torah talks about there's another din, you're not allowed to eat dam. You're not allowed to eat dam. Dam of a bird, of a chicken, a dam of behema, chaya, of is not allowed. Dam of a dog, is mutter. There's no requirement to salt the fish to remove the dam, But if you have chicken and you have meat, then you have to salt it in order to remove all of the dam. When you really salt it, so you will succeed in removing all of the dam, of course not, there's going to be a lot of dam left. So the halacha says, when you have a piece of meat and you salted it properly, so whatever dam remains is declared as mohel habasar, the juice of the meat. So the juice of the meat is mutter. So a lot of people are not allowed to eat the salt. A lot of people have a health problem. They're not allowed to have salt. So what they do is they take a big piece of meat, gigantic piece of meat, they salt it on all six sides, top and bottom, and the four sides around. And then after it sits for an hour, they wash it off. And then you get a piece of meat in the middle. It's full of blood. The salting on the outside absolutely didn't affect it whatsoever. But the halacha says that that's okay. So you're allowed to eat the middle piece of meat, even though it's full of blood, because he salted it according to the halacha. So whatever dam remains is considered mohel habasa, mem vav hei lamed, is the juice of the basa. The Talmud has a dispute regarding dam shebishlo. If you have dam from an animal that's aser, an isa kares, then you went ahead and you cooked it. Does it still have the isra of kares? Is it still awesome in HaTorah, or is it only awesome in the Rabban? So the Ramah paskens v'ashkenazim that it's only awesome in the Rabban. The Sfaradim have a big question, how Rabbi Yosef Kara paskens. It's unclear whether, as far as Sfaradim are concerned, whether this constitutes an Issa deraisa or an Issa derabbanan. Ashkenazim assume it's only midirabbanan. Why is it only midirabbanan? Because the din is, we're not allowed to eat dam, because the dam was, same as chelev put together, dam and chelev are put together in Chumash in a few places, because when you bring a korban to the Beis Hamikdash, you bring an offering on the Mizbeach, so you burn the chelev on the Mizbeach and you sprinkle the dam around. So because the dam and the chelev were intended to be chelek gavoa, it was intended for korbanos, so that's why the Torah prohibits us from eating dam and from eating chelev. So the halacha says, the Gemara says in Masech HaZvochim, that if you bring a korban and you collect the dam in a cup and then you cook it, and then you sprinkle it on the Mizbeach, you're not yotze the mitzvah. You have to sprinkle the dam when it's raw blood. Dam shebishlo, you're not yotze. The same thing, you have to burn the fat on the Mizbeach. If you cook the fat first, and then you burn it on the Mizbeach, you're not yotze. It has to be raw fat. So because of the fact that dam shebishlo is not roy lezrika, al-gabi ha-Mizbeach, it may not be used to make the korban kosher. So that's why the Talmud had this position, this opinion. That's how Ashkenazim paskin like that. The dam shebishlo, there's no isa deraisa on it. So why do you have to salt the meat? Just take the meat. You're not going to eat the meat raw. Take the meat and cook it. And once you cook it, so there's no isa deraisa. The answer is, but there's an isa midirabban. Dam shebishlo, there's an isa midirabban. It's important to know whether you're dealing with an isa deraisa and isa midirabban. Sometimes we have it in safik deraisa luchum and safik midirabban lekula. Well, let's say you're not sure whether dam got mixed into the soup or not. You're not sure whether dam got mixed in. See, even if dam did get mixed in, but by now it's dam shebishlo. So you're dealing only with an isa derabbanan. So if you're going to have a safek, so there's room to be mekel that safek derabbanan lekula. The Torah tells us that if you have a non-kosher pot or frying pan or forks and knives that are non-kosher, that you're not supposed to use them for kosher food later on, because the non-kosher bliya, that there always is absorption. Years ago, there always was absorption in normal kelim. Today, a lot of people use stainless steel pots and pans and stainless steel utensils, so stainless steel hardly has any bliya, hardly has any absorption at all. Has even less absorption than glass. And glass was a big dispute in the days of the Rishonim. The glass hardly has any bliya, hardly has any absorption at all. So Rabbi Yosef Kara writes in the Shulchan Aruch, for Sfardim, that's what they follow, that glass has only a bliya of mashahu, and you can use the same glass pots and pans for fleshings and for milch. You can cook in them, fleshings and milch, and many Sfardim follow that opinion. The Ramah writes in Hilchas Pesach, that Ashkenazim ha-machmer, that we treat glass as if it is boleya, and as if it's klicheres. Klicheres has a chumah that you can't even kasher, you can't even do hagolah. We'll get to that later. We'll have to discuss hagolah. So Ashkenazim follow that position. There is a discussion whether the chumrah of the Ramah, that we are machmah, that glass kelim are boleya, and you can't even kasher them, you can't even do hagolah. Does that only apply in Hilchas Pesach? That's what the Rambam writes, and he's only machmer for Pesach. Does chametz bePesach is b'mashehu? We're very machmer, or does he apply his chumer all year long? Then he non-kosher pot. So it's generally assumed, like the Prima Gadol in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch there in Hilchos Pesach, that the Rambam's chumer for the Ashkenazim applies all year long, not only to chametz bePesach, it applies all year long. So the Torah tells us in two different locations that if you have a non-kosher kli, you should realize that if you cook some food in a pot, you should realize that there's going to be an absorption. They didn't have stainless steel pots in the days of the Chumash. They didn't have glass either in the days of the Chumash. It was developed later. So there's always going to be absorption. So the Torah says you have to kash. The Torah in two different places writes about the kosherization process, and there seems to be a contradiction. In Parshas Tzav, the beginning of Chumash Vayikra, the Torah says, if you cook the korban chatos, if you broiled a korban chatos, either cooked or broiled the korban chatos in a pot. So korban chatos can only be eaten by kohanim in the Azorah, yom v'layla at chatzos. If you bring a korban, let's say it's 12:30 now, on today is Wednesday, I think. Okay. So if you bring a korban chatos in Beis HaMikdash today, 12:30, the kohanim can eat the chatos in the Azorah only up until midnight tonight, no more. So if you wait till tomorrow, someone will bring a korban chatos tomorrow and they'll broil it or cook it in the same pot that we broiled or we cooked the chatos today. So the bli of today's chatos will be absorbed into tomorrow's chatos and make a treif, because the kohanim will be eating tomorrow's chatos will be eating a little bit of today's chatos, and you're not allowed to eat it after midnight at night. So the Torah says you have to kasha the pot. Even everything is kosher. I broiled the chatos today. It's a kosher chatos. It's a mitzvah to broil it, mitzvah to cook it. The Dekanim should be able to eat it. So despite the fact that what the Talmud calls heterabola, everything was kosher. The kosher pot and kosher food, everything is kosher. But since it's going to sit in the pot till after midnight tonight, if I'm not going to kasher it, when I cook tomorrow's chatos, that's brought to 8 o'clock in the morning, tomorrow morning, I cook it in the same pot, so the bliya, the absorption from today's chatos, will enter into tomorrow's chatos, and the kohen will be eating the chatos from yesterday that's already nifsal belina, that it stayed overnight and not allowed to eat. So the Torah says they have to kasher the pot. So the Torah does not distinguish whether you cook the chatos or you broiled it. The Torah says, however, the chatos was prepared in the pot, you do hagola. Hagola means you put it into burning hot water and you assume the bliya will come out. In the end of Chumash Bamidbar, the Torah describes the Melchemes Midyan. God instructed the Jewish people to wage war against the nation of Midian because they started up with the Jews. So the Jews won the war, and the Torah says they had to kill all the soldiers. No one ever drafted women in the army, so they weren't allowed to kill anyone. Women were civilians. When you wage a war, you're not allowed to kill civilians. You're only allowed to kill soldiers. So they took little children, were not drafted in the army, and women were civilians, so they didn't kill them. So they took little children, captives of war. Women, they took captives of war. And then they captured also pots and the pans, the non-kosher pots and pans. So the Torah says, some of the women you have to put to death because they were getting the Jews involved in prohibited contacts with the women. And some of the women they were allowed to let live. And then as far as the non-kosher pots are concerned, so the Torah said it that the Yilkan Chumash at the end of Parshas Matos. So it says any broiler that they use to broil non-kosher meat, you have to do libunan. You have to burn out the treifa bliya, and any treifa soup pot that they cook treifa soup in, you have to do hagola on. You have to put it into burning hot water. So the Gemara poses this apparent contradiction. Why in Parshas Tzav, in the beginning of Chumash Vayikra, when the Torah talks about a pot that was used for cooking or broiling a korban chatos today, so it doesn't say a distinction. If you broil the korban chatos, it doesn't say you have to do libun. It doesn't say you have to burn out the treifa bliya of today's chatos. It just says you do hagol, you put the broiler into burning hot water. So why is it that in the end of Chumash Bamidbar and Parshas Matos, when the Jews won the war against Midian, so why is it over there? The Torah says it depends. Any pot that was used for broiling, you have to burn out the treif of Lia. And any pot that was used for cooking with roitev, with liquid, it's sufficient with hagol. So the Gemara asks this question, the last page in Maseches Avodah Zarah. So the Gemara answers that there's a difference. That by the Korban Chatos, it's hetera bola. Everything was kosher at the time that you cooked it. So whenever everything was kosher, there will never be any need for libon. It'll always be sufficient with hagola. But in the end of Chumash Bamidbar and Parshas Matos, when the Torah is talking about the non-kosher pots that the Midianim soldiers used to cook the chazarin, to cook the nevela meat in, so that's yisura bola. So whenever the treifus that was balua is yisura bola, so then the halacha requires that it sometimes needs libun. If the treifus was absorbed through the burning fire without any roitev, without any liquid, you broiled some treifus on a broiler, and it didn't require, it's not sufficient just to do hagol, you have to do libun. So halacha l'maaseh, this is relevant for us. Let's say you have a milchit broiler. I have a broiler that I used to use for cheese, to make cheese sandwiches. I want to make it parva, I want to make it fleishig. So the din is that the cheese, if the cheese was always kosher cheese, so it's hetera bola. So the din is that it would be sufficient to do hagola, there would be no need for libun. Because whenever it's hetera bola, you don't need libun. But if you have a broiler that you actually used it for non-kosher fish, let's say sometimes there's a fishery, there's a restaurant where they have fish, they used to be non-kosher, now they want to make it kosher, so they used to broil non-kosher fish on this, now they want to use everything for kosher, so then you have to kosher everything. So you would have to do libun on the broiler. There is another difference between hetera bola and isura bola, and that difference is known by its Rashi Tevis. Everybody calls it by the Rashi Tevis, not barnat. That means it stands for nuntes, not barnat, nais and tam, bar nais and tam. What it means is the following. The Gemara makes this distinction. If you cook non-kosher fish or non-kosher meat or non-kosher chicken or whatever in a pot, so the pot is treif. Let's say I scrubbed out the pot, I scoured it out, now it's clean, and I cook water in the pot. So the water becomes treif. If I pour the water into another pot, that makes the other pot treif. And then if I pour out the water, and then I cook new kosher water in the other pot. So the pot that became treif is going to transmit the treif of blia into the water. Then if I pour that new water into a third pot, that'll make that pot treif. A nice and tam, by nice and tam, by nice and tam, a tam from a tam from a tam, if it started off as really being treif, so it'll continue to make everything treif as you go along. But if it's not by not, the hetera, so then the Gemara says, it's muta. What is the Gemara's example of not bar not the hetera? So the Gemara says, let's say I have some fish was fried in a fleshing pot. So the fish has a blia from the fleshings. So you shouldn't put butter. You shouldn't pour milk, you shouldn't put butter into the fish. Fine. Then the person takes the fish and he puts it that's a bad example. That's the wrong example. Let's say a person that he just a minute. Let's say a person has a burning hot piece of fish, and he puts it on a fleshy plate. He puts it on a fleshy plate. The fleshy plate is not hot, but the fish is burning hot. So because the fish is burning hot, so it will absorb a little from the fleshy blia that's in the plate. So the Gemara says, since it's only a blia, so I'm permitted later on to have it with melchiks. Because that's a not bar not. So this is a question, does this only apply if you had the burning hot fish was put on a fleshy plate? What if I cooked the fish in a fleshy pot? What if it's not bar not, I dey bishul? So that's a big dispute between the Ashkenazim and the Svardim. Ashkenazim are machmer on that if you cooked fish in a fleshig pot, you have to treat the fish as if it's fleshig, and you shouldn't mix in butter. And the Svardim are mekel on that. that even if you cooked it in a fleshic pot, it doesn't become fleshic. Still considered parva. The Gemara has an interesting din that is quoted in Shulchan Aruch that biblically it's only required to kasher a pot if it was used for non-kosher in the last 24 hours. But if a pot was used for non-kosher a few days ago, or my grandmother used it years ago, my grandmother didn't keep kosher, and now I yarshin, I get this Yerusha of all these tray for pots and pans. So the Gemara says, biblically, min haTorah, since 24 hours have gone by, since the pots were used for non-kosher, so there's no need to kasher the pots. The Rabbanon, the rabbis required that even exera ena ben yomo otame yomo, that's called the kli ben yomo, as opposed to a kli she'ena ben yomo. Is it within 24 hours of when it became trey, or is it after 24 hours? And with the Rabbanon, we require that even after 24 hours, you still have to kasher. When I was just in Eretz Yisrael visiting the different yeshivas, so the different kinds of yeshivas there. So one of the, I visited a few yeshivas, but they have a lot of Balei Tshuva. So the question is always asked. A lot of times the parents are not so observant, and the parents don't keep kosher. So what are they going to do? They know that the pots in the home are used for non-kosher food. So in the Shulchan Aruch they quote the following. Let's say by mistake I have a non-kosher pot that has not been used for treifas in the last 24 hours. So mid the Rabbana, we require that you have to kasher the pot. What if I forgot to kasher the pot? I went ahead and I cooked something or I baked something in the pot. So since it's after 24 hours, so it doesn't make anything treif. So b'diyeved, the kosher food that I'll cook in the pot will be kosher. So the Shulchan Aruch quotes from Tosfos that since b'diyeved, the food would be kosher, so if you're faced with the situation of a shas hadchak, so we permit you l'chatchila in a shas hadchak circumstance to do what's usually only permissible b'diyeved. So in the Shulchan Aruch, the original case that he quotes is the following. The Jews never owned a bakery for many centuries. The Jews didn't own bakeries. They used to bake kosher bread by renting the baking tins of the non-Jews and renting the right to use the non-kosher bakery. So the non-Jews used to bake bread with lard. So the baking tins were treif. They had a blea of lard. Now in New England, it's very, very rare. It's almost non-existent at all that they should bake bread with lard. Italian breads in New York area are all kosher. You don't need any extra Italian bread, they're never treif. You don't put anything that's treif. Most of the breads in New England, they don't use lard either. They may be treif for other reasons, but nobody ever puts in lard anymore. But years ago, the non-Jews used to bake all the breads with lard. So the baking tins were treif, but they wouldn't give the Jews permission to burn out their tins. They didn't want them to ruin their baking tins. So how are they going to make bread? And years ago, everybody ate bread. If you know Europeans, they eat 6 slices of bread in a meal. Israelis also like that. 7 slices of bread in every meal. That's the main part. Americans now hardly eat any bread. We only eat on Shabbos and Yom Tov. But years ago, everybody ate bread. So they use an expression, al halechem yichyeh ha'adam. The Torah says, not on bread alone does man live. Lo al halechem levado yichyeh ha'adam. But the Rishonim say, al halechem yichyeh ha'adam. The slices of bread were the main part of the meal. So the Rishonim says, since you're faced with the shas hadchak, the Jews don't own their own bakery. You have to rent the right for the non-Jews to bake the bread. Bread is not a luxury, it's a necessity. You can't live without bread. It's one of the major staples of the meals. So you're permitted l'chatchila to bake the kosher bread on a non-kosher baking tin if 24 hours went by, because since b'diyeved, if you would bake it, it would be kosher. So b'shas hadchak, we permit l'chatchila, but usually is only allowed b'diyeved. So that's in Shulchan Aruch. So that's sometimes people are faced with such a situation at home. Their parents don't keep kosher. And they can't keep on kashering all the pots and pans. Their parents won't let them kasher the pots and pans. If 24 hours went by, so then they're stuck. Look, when they'll get married, they'll have their own home and they'll lead their own life. But as long as they're living by their parents, they can't do what they want to do. So then we would say that it would be, under such circumstances, we would permit l'chatchila to cook kosher food in a treifa pot, if you know that it's clean, there's no treifas in the pot now, and we know for sure that 24 hours went by since the last time that they cooked treifas. Sometimes you have an ice cream factory, and they have a run of Milchig ice cream and have a run of Parva ice cream. And sometimes it's impossible to kasher in between. The company doesn't let them kasher. So the question is, how much of a Shas Hadchak is that to have Parva ice cream? The world can exist without Milchig ice cream. We can certainly exist without Parva ice cream. So there we would not be lenient. We would not permit them to say, well, just wait 24 hours in between the Milchig ice cream and Parva ice cream, and Shas Hadchak had he ever done. That's not a Shas Hadchak. But on bread, bread is al alech miyichi ha'adam, so that's considered a Shas Hadchak. The Chacham Tzvi was an Ashkenazi rabbi who lived in Vilna, same time as the Shach in the 1600s, and then they had the Chmelnytsky riots then, so everybody had run for their lives, many people were killed. So he ran to London, then he ran to Amsterdam. He was the Chacham in a Sephardic community, but he himself was not a Sephardi, he was an Ashkenazi. He was the father of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who lived in Germany, in Emden, Hamburg. So the Chacham Tzvi has a lot of famous tshuvas. One of them is on this following topic, that true, you have to kasher a treifer pot even if 24 hours went by from the last time that you cooked treifers in it. The Gemara says that midirabbanon, one is required to kasher the treifer pot, but that's only if the pot was used for treifers in the last 12 months. But if 12 months went by and it wasn't used at all for any treifers, then you don't even have to kasher midirabbanon. Where did he get this idea from? From thin air. The Gemara says this with respect to barrels which were containing non-kosher wine. The rabbis were concerned about intermarriage. Intermarriage is now higher than it ever was in the history of the world. Intermarriage. So there was always a serious concern of it. Jews are always assimilating, always intermarrying. So the rabbis made a lot of prohibitions in order to prevent, in order to deter, in order to slow down intermarriage. So they said, we're not allowed to eat kosher food that's cooked by a non-Jew, mishalachim. You're not allowed to eat bread that's baked by a non-Jew. You're not allowed to drink wine that's manufactured by a non-Jew. And then while they were on the topic of the wine that's manufactured by the non-Jew, they said, even if the wine is manufactured by the Jewish company, but if a non-Jew handled it, you shouldn't drink it either, because there's a concern. In the days of the Tanoim, the non-Jews were so religiously oriented, they were crazy about their religion. They would, whenever they would see any wine, even though their Avodah Zarah is in a different continent, the Avodah Zarah, the totem pole that they worship is in a totally different location, they would pour the wine here as an act of Avodah Zarah for their Avodah Zarah that was in a different location, even though it's not in the presence of the Avodah Zarah. So Tosfos explains in the Gemara, the rabbis would not have introduced a prohibition against wine handled by a non-Jew because maybe he was menasechit for Avodah Zarah. It's such a far-fetched chashash, it's highly unlikely. But they were concerned, their main concern was about intermarriage, and they prohibited bread that's baked, let's say, by my next-door neighbor bakes kosher bread in my presence, and kosher pots and pans. I see all the ingredients are kosher, the pot is kosher. I'm not allowed to eat the bread because it may lead to intermarriage. And even if my next-door neighbor doesn't have any daughters, so the Shulchan Aruch, my next-door neighbor is a galach, is a minister, and the ministers are supposedly celibate, so they don't have any children. So it still says the rabbis prohibited eating the bread made by the non-Jew, even if he doesn't have any children. So they prohibited pasakum, the bread made by the non-Jew, bishalakum, food that was cooked by the non-Jew, and stam yenu, because the wine that's manufactured by the non-Jew, because this may lead to intermarriage. So once they prohibit, that's a real concern. So once they prohibited drinking the wine that was manufactured by the non-Jews, so then they threw in an added chumrah. Not only shouldn't you drink it, you shouldn't gain any pleasure, you shouldn't get any benefit from it either. Maybe the non-Jew used it for a religious ritual for Avodah Zarah, became Asur Ba'ano. And even if the non-Jew handled kosher wine that was manufactured by Jews, also you shouldn't drink it, because maybe he was menasechet l'shem Avodah Zarah. So the Gemara says if you have barrels that contain non-kosher wine, but they haven't had any non-kosher wine in the last 12 months, so then you don't have to kosher the barrels. But if the barrels contain wine, non-kosher wine within the last 12 months, then the Gemara has long discussions in the end of Masechet Avodah Zarah, how are you supposed to kosher those barrels? So the Chacham Tzvi took that Gemara and he extended it to all non-kosher pots and pans. Whenever you have a non-kosher pot that hasn't been used in 12 months for non-kosher food, you don't have to kosher at all. So his opinion was never accepted. But if you have other tzirufim, other considerations, so then the poskim would be noita lahakam. So take, for example, there was a one of the big geniuses of all time was Rav Aharon Halevi, the Ra'or, who was a student of the Ramban. He had a brother, Rav Pinchas Halevi, who was a super genius, and they always came up with novel, original chidushim. So one of the chidushim of Rav Aharon Halevi was he did not have two sets of dishes. He said, you don't need two sets of dishes, fleshig and milchig. You only wait 24 hours, put a label on when is the last time you use it for fleshig, when is the last time you use it for milchig, and wait 24 hours. The Gemara says, you're not allowed to wait 24 hours and use it. No, that's if it was treif. But it was all fleshig or just milchig, it was never treif. They never made it xerah d'rabban. So his students pleaded with him, Rebbe, we know that you're right, but everybody says you're a goy, you're an apikoros. So why don't you buy two sets of dishes? No, right is right, matter of principle. He's not going to have two sets of dishes. So we don't accept his opinion, but if you have the pots and pans were never used for the last 12 months, and they were never treif in the first place, they were just fleshig. So you have Rav Aharon Halevi to rely on, and you have the Chacham Tzvi to rely on. So then some poskim would be mitzar of these two. In certain cases, not all the time to be maker. Rav Moshe Feinstein sometimes has kulas. Rabbi Akiva Eger before him has kulas. If you have enough considerations together, even though based on any one consideration alone, we wouldn't be lenient. But if you have a combination of a few considerations, then there's what to be lenient about. The Gemara says you're not allowed to eat food that's unhealthy. Some of my best friends eat food that's unhealthy. Not allowed to overeat. It's unhealthy. Not allowed to, you have to eat nourishing food. In the days of the Talmud, it was considered unhealthy to eat fish that was cooked with meat. Because they felt that one could develop negatzaras by this diet. In later generations, the Magen Avraham is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. It was written in the late 1600s. He says in his generation, the doctors never heard of such a thing. And they don't think that there's any sakana if the meat and the fish were cooked together. So the Nevi Yehuda from the 1700s says, he's still shaky. He's not sure. Magen Avraham felt there's no sakana, and the Nevi Yehuda felt maybe there still is a sakana. The bottom line, we should follow in the footsteps of the rabbis. The rabbis didn't know medicine, and they didn't know biology. They relied on the doctors of their generation, whatever the doctors told them. It's unhealthy, so you're not allowed to eat it. So we should do the same today. If the doctors today say that smoking is unhealthy, and cholesterol is unhealthy, and schmaltz is unhealthy, and fatting foods is unhealthy, whatever they say is unhealthy. So we're not allowed to get involved. We have to be more careful about our health than you had. The Gemara says, Chamira Sakanta Misu, you have to be more careful about your health than you have to about keeping kosher. I have only covered a skeleton outline of some of the laws of kashrus. You should realize that there's much more to cover, but the period is over. Okay. Have a tzlocha. Have a nice week. What's the topic for next week? So we'll find out.